The deadly impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on the most deprived areas in England and Wales has been even more pronounced than first thought, according to new research that reveals the northwest of England lost 3 times more years of life than the southwest. Deaths have been unevenly distributed socio-economically and geographically ever since the crisis began. However, until now, the full scale of inequalities has been underestimated, a study published in the journal PLOS Medicine has suggested. Comparing the number of deaths during the pandemic with data from previous years can shed light on its impact, researchers said. But looking at excess deaths alone underestimates years of life lost and does not account for the differences in ages at which people die in different social groups. In the new study, led by the University of Manchester, researchers measured years of life lost attributable to the pandemic, directly or indirectly, as well as excess deaths. Years of life lost is a strong measure of premature mortality because it takes into account both the number of deaths and the age at which they occur. The findings of the new analysis are striking, Manchester University researchers say, and suggest the true toll of the pandemic has been even deadlier in poorer areas of England than initially thought. The impact of the pandemic, when quantified using years of life lost, was higher than previously thought on the most deprived areas of England and Wales, widening pre-existing health inequalities, said Evangelos Kontopantelis, who led the research. Between March and December of 2020, 1,645 years of life were lost per 100,000 of the population in the most deprived areas of England and Wales. In the most affluent areas of England and Wales, 916 years of life were lost per 100,000 people. The figures mean that almost twice as many years of life were lost in the very poorest areas of the country compared with the wealthiest. Broken down by geographic region, the highest rate was found in the northwest of England, where 1,550 years of life were lost per 100,000 of the population. The northeast of England, with 1,519 years of life lost, was the second worst hit area, followed by the West Midlands, with 1,475 years of life lost. The lowest rate was in the southwest of England, where 490 years of life were lost per 100,000 of the population. Next was the south central region of England, with 735 years of life lost, followed by the east of England, with 779 years of life lost. There was a difference of 729 excess years of life lost between the most deprived and the least deprived groups of people in England and Wales. Stark inequalities were also found when examining excess deaths, especially in younger age groups, the researchers said. There were 11 times as many excess deaths in deprived areas compared with the most affluent areas in 15 to 44-year-olds, 3 times as many in 45 to 64-year-olds, and almost twice as many in 65 to 74-year-olds. Excess deaths were 40% higher in 75 to 84-year-olds living in the most deprived areas of England and Wales compared with the least. Inequalities between socio-economic and geographic groups resulting from the COVID-19 pandemic are more pronounced than previously reported, the Manchester University researchers wrote. They added that future plans to manage pandemics should include an understanding of regional and socio-economic variation in years of life lost and how this has exacerbated long-standing health inequalities. Hannah Davis of the Northern Health Science Alliance, who was not involved with the new research, said the study was further evidence of how devastating the impact of COVID-19 has been in communities in the north of England that were already suffering from deprivation before the coronavirus pandemic. Claire Bamborough, a professor of public health at the University of Newcastle, added, "These findings reiterate that the pandemic has been very unequal. People in our most deprived communities have suffered most."
What would have happened if Hezbollah had been vanquished? That's perhaps the most significant and upsetting question of the 2006 war. How did Hezbollah defeat Israel?
Part 1.
Much has been said about the 2006 war, about its motives, the behind the scenes, and the circumstances around it, its planning and developments, its details and objectives, as well as its outcome and the lessons learned from the war. Also, much speculation has been made about what led to the war when considering the situation in Lebanon, in the occupying Zionist regime, in Palestine, and in the region, as well as the U.S. role in the war. One of the main issues that needs a close look is what would have happened if the resistance in Lebanon was defeated.
Speaking of a hypothetical defeat would not be possible without examining the history of Arab defeats. Just as one cannot hypothesize about Hezbollah's defeat without taking into account the nature and identity of the supposed winner. There are two other questions that have to be asked. One is, how did Israel overcome the Arabs? And the other is, how did Hezbollah defeat Israel? Only then can one hypothesize about the consequences of a Hezbollah defeat in the 2006 war. In the first two episodes, we will take a stab at the first question, how did Israel overcome the Arabs? This episode deals with the wars between Israel and the Arabs, especially the battle that the Arabs started with a surprise attack. This is a story of two wars in the last century, one in 1948 and the other in 1973, an account unheard of from officers of the classic Arab armies. The story is based on investigations by the military research of the Islamic Resistance. Israel's War for Occupation of Palestine, the Great Nakba. This is one of the oldest known pictures of Palestine. It shows the high walls of Al-Quds and the inner parts of the city. It was taken 111 years before the occupation of Palestine, a viable piece of evidence that negates the Zionists' claim that the territory they occupied had been uninhabited. Living here for centuries are a people known as Palestinians. This territory has been home to their feasts and celebrations. They have toiled here and cultivated the land. They have picked olives scattered across the hills surrounding Al-Quds. They have collected wheat in Al-Jalil and bananas, oranges, and watermelons in Jaffa and Haifa. They have fished with cast nets off the coasts of Palestine to feed their families. These young girls have filled clays with water for men who broke stones to build their houses. This is the story of a nation that lived here for centuries until an obscure foreign regime emerged and began farming on their lands and brought in new people to replace the old nation.
الذي يخرج من ذاته ومشاعره من بيئته ومحيطه.
If someone takes a detached view of the region, free from his feelings for his motherland, he would see an Islamic Arabic setting and the Ottoman state that is a great Islamic caliphate. On the other side, he sees a small group of Jews scattered around the world who have been expelled from the entire human society. These Jews came together and said, "We will create our own government, but where?" They picked the focal point of attention of different religions in the region. They picked a place which pulses with a history of the great prophets, a highly regarded place at the heart of this Arabic Islamic setting. Therefore, they considered it a success when they established their regime there.
In 1837, 110 years before the birth of the Israeli regime, work on the first ever Jewish settlement on Palestinian soil began. An estimated 1,500 Jews lived in Palestine in 1837. The number grew to 10,000 in 3 years and reached 22,000 by 1881. Most of the Jews lived within the Al-Quds territory. Another 25,000 of them arrived in Palestine between 1881 and 1903. In 1910, the Jews established their first plantation in Palestine. Although the plantations were of no economic value, the Jewish movement wanted Jews to work on the agricultural tracts, to tie them to the soil and the land. At the outset of the First World War, the number of Jews had reached 85,000. They possessed some 384 square kilometers of land and around 44 plantations.
The Israelis did not occupy Palestine all at once. They rather seized it by small pieces before fully swallowing it, and it was done through creation of settlements. A settlement is not a housing or residential complex. It is rather a castle with logistical facilities, weapons depots, barracks, and other military features for soldiers, while accommodating them and their families. In a Jewish settlement, people live in well-protected homes inside a castle where they have full access to everything they need, including food, drinks, and items of welfare. This is the full lifestyle of a hybrid society, one that consists of different nationalities and identities that live in the shadow of weapons. Jews got the idea of forming such communities from the Americans and how they dealt with Indians, as well as from the British handling of Africa and India.
During the First World War, the number of the Jews living in Palestine dropped to around 55,000. Many left their promised land for their safer countries of origin. Yet a month after the Balfour Declaration, British forces occupied Palestine. After a long siege, General Allenby finally entered Al-Quds, defended courageously by the Ottoman forces. The first thing the British did after capturing Palestine was they opened the door to Jewish migrants. In 1919, a wave of Jewish migrants headed back to Palestinian coasts. In less than 30 days, hundreds of ships took 355,000 Jews to Palestine. Subsequently, the Jews used the help of their powerful ally and began to confiscate Palestinian land to build their settlements on. These pictures show the initial construction phases of Tel Aviv, a coastal settlement near Jaffa in Palestine, a settlement that would become the capital city of the new regime. From 1917 on, Palestinians took up arms to defend their lands, and the armed struggle continued until the occupation of Palestine and the foundation of the Zionist regime. They launched a series of armed struggles and movements. This is perhaps the rare pictures that shows the Palestinian flag bearing a crescent and a cross. A flag belonged to the fighters of the 1936 movement that lasted for 3 years before its fighters were suppressed and imprisoned by the British forces. The Palestinian fighters attacked British bases and convoys, and the British torched their crops. 1,000 Palestinians, 200 British troops, and 300 Jews were killed in the 1936 Intifada. Perhaps it is one of the unreported episodes of Palestinian history. In which Palestinian fighters forced Jews out of Al-Quds after a long battle. These pictures show the British-backed Jews leaving Al-Quds. It happened 12 years after the occupation of Palestine. The Jews' migration to Palestine did not stop, kept arriving on its shores from Cyprus, some in daylight, and others used the dark cover of the night. It all ended with the support and knowledge of the British colonizers. They began training Jews, leading to the emergence of gangs such as Argon, Shetron, and Haganah.
I was a member of the Haganah underground mobilized unit fund in helping the British to invade the Levant, Lebanon, and Syria that were under Vichy, a government that collaborated with Hitler's Germany. Till night, together with the British, we were trained by them, seen by them in sabotage activities in case Rommel will succeed to capture Egypt and to invade Palestine.
Later, Menachem arrives in Palestine to lead Argon. As David Ben-Gurion sends his envoys to Europe to buy Jews the arms they need. Meanwhile, Golda Meir is taking a tour of the U.S. to raise money for the purchasing of the new arms shipments. Weapons flow into Palestine, and Israeli terrorist groups commit the Deir Yassin massacre on April 9, 1948. They slaughter 254 people. Filling defenseless Palestinian citizens with terror.
Before its establishment, Israel had a powerful ally that in the first place allowed tens of thousands of Jews into Palestine and then provided them with training and arms. Only then, Israeli gangs emerged and began to establish settlements. The Zionist gangs attacked safe Palestinian towns and terrified their residents, who were defenseless Palestinian farmers. Israel gradually seized Palestinian territories. Zionists occupied towns and villages, which were abandoned after their residents heard the news of massacres from here and there. That was how Israel laid its foundation. Therefore, one can say the relation with their powerful British ally, the trained and armed military groups, and the endless creation of settlements were the strategic triangle for the foundation of Israel.
The establishment of the Zionist regime in Tel Aviv, a coastal settlement near Jaffa, was declared at 1600 local time on May 15, 1948, just 8 hours before the official end of the British mandate for Palestine.
Before leaving Palestine, the British informed Jews of their withdrawal plan so that they knew the exact time of the withdrawal and the strategic places they had to enter and control. After a 31-year colonization, Britain pulled out of Palestine when Zionist groups were ready to enter any battle to defend themselves.
British Army officer David Ben-Gurion read out the declaration of the establishment of the Israeli and became Israel's first prime minister and a symbol of its might. At the time, the new colonizers shed tears of happiness for the foundation of their regime and danced to the tune of their national anthem. Less than 24 hours, Arab armies declared war on Israel, a move welcomed with flowers and embraces by the Palestinians. The armies of Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq, joined by Palestinian volunteers, launched the war on Israel. They called it the Battle for the Liberation of Palestine. The Jews referred to it as the Israeli Independence War. Arab forces fought a fierce battle and scored a victory with initial successes. Egypt lost its city of Aqaba to the Israelis at the beginning of the war. But the Syrians managed to liberate the city of Samak and take over the two Israeli settlements of Shar HaGolan and Masada. On the northern front, the Lebanese military and volunteer forces took control of the Malkia and Qadas villages in Al-Jalil. In the first hours of the conflict, Egyptian aircraft bombed Tel Aviv while vanguard forces advanced to a position 70 kilometers away from the Zionist regime's capital. At the time, the most violent clashes erupted in Al-Quds, especially in Bab al-Wad and Latrun, where 1,200 Jordanian soldiers, assisted by Palestinian and Arab volunteers, fought off 6,500 Israeli soldiers led by Ariel Sharon. They managed to block them from entering the holy city. Israeli aggressors suffered heavy casualties, estimated at 800 to 2,000. Sharon himself was also wounded in the battle for Al-Quds. The United Nations Security Council intervened in the conflict on July 10, 1940, and ordered a month-long ceasefire. At the time, Abdullah bin Hussein of Jordan, accompanied by senior officers of Arab armies, entered Al-Quds. He was welcomed by residents rejoicing at their return to the city from where they had been forcefully removed. One of the characteristics of the war was that the Israeli army was formed 2 weeks after the creation of the Zionist regime and in the heat of the battles with Arab armies and volunteer forces. The number of the Zionists' military forces is estimated to have been anywhere between 62 to 100,000 men and women. They were organized in the form of 12 brigades, including infantry and artillery units, which the British left for the Israelis. The Israeli army was mostly led by British officers and used Spitfire and Mrs. Schumann aircraft in the 1948 war. They faced 25,000 forces on the Arab front, including soldiers and volunteers. Within the Zionists' ranks were veteran soldiers who had fought in the Second World War. The British Army's Jewish Brigade, formed during World War II, played an active role in the 1948 conflict. They barricaded two Zionist settlements that resembled castles. The settlements had been constructed with military purposes in mind. Each was a complete defensive compound with alarm systems and watchtowers. When the Arabs were busy celebrating the recapture of Al-Quds, the fledgling Al-Quds army was forming its first armored brigade, including a regiment comprised of two battalions of 14 tanks, which later came to be known in the war literature as the British and Soviet battalions. The ceasefire ended and the battle resumed, but this time the Israelis had the upper hand and the war took a completely different turn. 2 weeks into the war, four Israeli aircraft, hurriedly called back from Czechoslovakia, began raiding the Egyptian army positions and limited their advancement. The aircraft were operated by elite pilots whose skills had been put to the test in World War II. By contrast, the Egyptian pilots were inexperienced beginners whose planes were downed by Israeli anti-aircraft artillery. The harmony among the Israeli infantry, armored and air units cut through the Arab armies. It forced back the Egyptian army and halted the Jordanian and Syrian armies' advancements. In a matter of 9 days, the Palestine Liberation War came to an end, but the exchange of fire between the two sides continued until the end of October, as Israel extended its control over a vast swath of Palestinian lands. These pictures show Israeli forces riding horses that remind the viewers of Western movies. These horsemen took control of the tunnel passages area, and their control was strongest at Bir al-Sabah. At the end of October 1948, the upper Al-Jalil was under the full control of the Israelis. Apart from how the Arab Rescue Army and the other Arab armies perform in the 1948 war, Arab officers, soldiers, and volunteers put up an impressive defense and managed to kill 6,373 Israelis, the largest number of Israeli casualties ever in all the wars they had fought. The Iraqi army was on the verge of breaking the siege of Haifa, but their troops' advancement was halted due to political pressure back in Baghdad. 165,000 Arabs managed to hold on to their 1948 land against about 900,000 who were displaced. These pictures show the first moments when Palestinians were forced from their homeland. Some of them show the disgusted civilians in Jaffa being hurried towards boats that would take them to faraway places. And these pictures record the first moments when Jewish migrants arrived at Arab vicinities just hours after their real owners were forced to escape.
شعب بأكمله خرج ليحل محله شعب جديد.
A whole nation was removed so that another nation could take its place. What scattered Jews across Palestine managed to do was extraordinary. A nation that did not exist forced another nation out of its lands and took its place in the middle of a volatile Islamic-dominated environment. And despite the fact that Jews accounted for only 4.5% of the Palestinian population. How did Israel manage to preserve the land for 60 years while it has no historical or religious right to stay there?
On February
24, 1949, an armistice agreement based on a UN Security Council resolution was signed between Arab countries and the Zionist regime. The agreement ensured continued migration of Jews to Palestine. Every month, tens of thousands of them arrived from Europe and Arab countries. They were initially sent to hundreds of camps across Palestine where they learned Hebrew and underwent military training. Gradually, tents turned into cement buildings, which were in turn turned into large settlements. But today, despite the massacres and forced evacuations of the Palestinians, the demographic element remains a key security weakness of the Zionist regime. Currently, 5.5 million Jews live in the 1948 territories, along with 1.2 million Arabs. 2.5 million Palestinians live in the Gaza Strip, and another 1.5 million in Gaza. In other words, the entire population of Jews in Palestine is 5.5 million against the Palestinian population of 5.2 million. Israel faces major security setbacks and weaknesses, especially in geographical terms, since it's surrounded by four Arab countries: Egypt, Syria, Jordan, and Lebanon. It has a longitude of 985 kilometers that makes it an easy target for attacks from different fronts. Israel's other weakness that affects its military strategy is its area. Palestine is oblong on the map and spans across an area of 22,145 square kilometers. It is 470 kilometers long and 135 kilometers at its widest. In Palestine, the distance between the Mediterranean on the west and the Dead Sea on the east is a 90-minute drive. And one can travel from its northernmost city of Matali to its southernmost city of Eilat in 9 hours. This geographical fact hugely limits the Israeli forces' movement and gives a vital strategic privilege to any advancing Arab force. The occupied territories are 14 kilometers wide at their narrowest. That's an ideal strategic depth for artillery fire. And that's why Israel is clinching to the lands it occupied in 1967. Israel has so far refused to withdraw from the Golan Heights, since the area provides it with a highly needed strategic depth. The return of the Golan to Syria gives any Syrian offensive force a key advantage against Israel, since the Syrian border is less than 37 kilometers away from Palestine and the cities of Haifa and Acre. That means Syrian forces would need only minutes to arrive at the two strategic Zionist cities in case of an attack. This very fact has so far barred Syria and the Zionist regime from signing a peace deal. The Camp David agreement with Egypt was far easier for the Israelis compared to a peace deal with Syria. Israel agreed to pull its forces out of the Sinai only when a clause was added to the peace treaty that limited the number of Egyptian soldiers in the area to two regiments. That made the Sinai a natural barrier, preventing an Egyptian surprise attack against Israel. And that's why Israel agreed to retreat from the Sinai and not from the Golan Heights. Israel's appropriation of the lands it has occupied merits attention. The first Jewish settlement in the Sinai was established just 4 months after the 1967 war and soon grew into 12 colonies. After the signing of the Camp David peace treaty, Israel did not accept to remove Jews living in the Sinai and abandon the lands it had occupied. It knew it had taken over the lands by force and would have to use force to remove the Jews from the settlements.
God has bestowed these lands to the Jewish nation, and the Jewish law forbids abandoning of these lands. We will not give up on even one centimeter of these lands. We will fight to the end, even for a single centimeter of this soil.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
This is theft on a massive scale, and it is being done at a time when Afghanistan desperately needs an infusion of funds, says Daniel Larrison, writer, in an article published under the heading, Biden Commits a Grave Injustice Against the Afghan People. Stay tuned for more. The Biden administration is going to rob the people of Afghanistan of billions of dollars of their own money. Biden is starting to clear a legal path for relatives of victims of September 11, 2001 attacks to pursue $3.5 billion that Afghanistan's central bank had deposited in New York before the Taliban takeover, while also seeking to steer a roughly equal amount toward spending to aid the Afghan people. Beginning that process, Biden issued an executive order invoking emergency powers to consolidate and freeze all $7 billion of the total assets the Afghan Central Bank kept in New York. The administration said it would ask a judge for permission to move $3.5 billion to a trust fund it would set up to support the needs of the Afghan people, like for humanitarian relief. Instead of releasing funds to Afghanistan's central bank and allowing some level of normal economic activity to resume, the administration has managed to find an indefensible way to release the funds. The Humanitarian Trust Fund is an attempt to set up a mechanism outside of Afghanistan's institutions to funnel aid into the country, but the aid is going to be a trickle compared to what the Afghan people need to survive and recover. Emerson Brooking commented recently, "This is not just frozen assets, it is the entire reserve of the Afghan Central Bank. This act will destroy whatever remained of the formal Afghan economy. It will make Afghanistan entirely reliant on small rations of foreign aid. The decision to divide the money and keep half for families of 9/11 victims is outrageous, and it is difficult to see how the U.S. has any legal authority to use the funds in this way. The U.S. is simply taking the money because no one can stop it from doing so." The U.S. is supposed to be keeping that money in trust on behalf of Afghanistan's government. There is no good reason why money that belongs to the people of Afghanistan should be handed over to the victims of a crime committed by non-Afghans decades ago. This is theft on a massive scale, and it is being done at a time when Afghanistan desperately needs an infusion of funds. The Biden administration may think that it is staving off criticism from hawks by keeping the money for victims' families, but it is so cynical and morally bankrupt that it is rightly provoking a much bigger backlash than a simple unfreezing of assets over and ever would have. Murtaza Hussain adds, "If Trump had done this, it would have been the most outrageous and vicious foreign policy thing he did during his entire presidency by far. Almost incomprehensible. The United States regime is choosing to rob starving people in the middle of a humanitarian crisis created by the U.S. government's own policies. It is one more example of how U.S. punishes innocent people around the world for the crimes of others." Doc Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Dispossession, the great social housing swindle directed by Paul Sung. And joining me in this episode are Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian, The Telegraph, and many other outlets. And beside him is Claudia Webb, who is a Labour Party councillor in the London Borough of Islington. Now, Dispossession is a documentary that explores the catastrophic failures by successive governments that have led to a chronic shortage of social housing in Britain. The film focuses on the neglect, demolition and regeneration of council estates across the UK and investigates how the state works with the private sector to demolish council estates to build the land they stand on, making properties that are unaffordable to the majority of people.
They're going to regenerate it, which means total demolition. And when it very first started, it was a case of nothing will happen without your approval. Well, that was lie number one on day one, and it's never changed.
We've got councils of all kinds across London who are trying to demolish traditional council estates. They're actually destroying communities.
It was Mrs. Thatcher whose right to buy scheme was a vote winner for families like the Pattersons. She gave them the title deeds to their council house. They gave her tea in return.
Don't you think this is lovely?
The right to buy was probably the most popular policy ever introduced by Conservative government.
Housing is a fundamental human need, and it's one the market just doesn't seem to be capable of providing.
We should be building every year about 240,000, 250,000 homes, and we're nowhere near that.
I want there to be no hope areas in the new Britain that we want to create.
Essentially, we've had successive governments that simply haven't seen the role for social housing, and they've been cutting it.
It's not seen as being aspirational, and aspiration is the key word.
For the last 10, 20 years, housing stock that used to be here is down, it's gone.
Access to housing in Glasgow, to social housing, is nigh on impossible.
They are tearing apart our community, brick by brick, and we're not going to let them.
Welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary tackles a very serious problem facing this country, and it was a very moving and deeply personal documentary for the director, I believe, as he grew up on a council estate. And especially in the wake of the Grenfell Tower tragedy, this film comes at a very important time. Mike, if I can start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
I was very impressed by it. I thought the first time I saw this film, I was a little bit concerned about how compacted it was, the amount of information it crams into an hour and, I think, 26 minutes. The second time I saw it, I was impressed by the amount of information that it did get in, the amount of ground that it covers, the fact that it covers all these issues from so many different angles. I mean, you're getting the input of the politicians who have to make the policy decisions that cause estates to be built or to be knocked down. Mm-hmm. You're also getting the input from people on the ground, residents of the estates, who have a very different take on it. So I'm a big fan of this film.
So as you say, this documentary, it was very dense, packed with information, statistics, and usually these films are quite difficult to watch. So do you think the director was successful in conveying his message then?
Yes, because in part I think that it makes its points pictorially. I mean, it is very crisply shot, and it's one of those situations where I think if we're walking down a street anywhere, this is the kind of issue that hits you smack in the face. You know, we could go for a walk around the studios here, and we would see 3, 4, 5 luxury flat developments, springing up everywhere. But we'd probably see more homeless people than we'd see social housing developments going up. And the film is very acutely attuned to what is actually happening at street level, and it shows you the disrepair that many estates have fallen into, and it contrasts that with the slightly sort of eerie gloom of these new developments going up that don't seem to be inhabited by anyone because no one's got the money to afford to move in there.
And Claudia, if I could turn to you now, as someone who works closely with this issue, is the social housing crisis in this country as bad as the documentary suggests it is?
Well, the documentary highlights quite well, actually, the state of play of council housing and council house in the UK, and in particular, actually, in London, and the sort of the dilemma that councils face as against the sort of the notion of community, the notion of identity, and the notion of neighbourhood, the concept of fairness. Right at the very heart of an urban inner city area, and what does a home mean? And it begins to explore what that means today, as against what it should have meant, and what we've got really in terms of what the documentary is portraying and what the film's portraying is this whole issue of council homes being sold off for profit. Council land being sold off for profit and exposing really a reality and dichotomy of huge waiting lists, homelessness, and yet council homes
been sold in off-profit against that sort of waiting list. Mm-hmm. And then what happens to communities and what happens to neighbourhoods? It's a stark contrast, and the film has really brought home and brought out the realities of the dangers of making the wrong decisions.
Indeed, and this documentary, one of the key messages is that a home is a right and not a privilege.
We need to offer housing to people at lower rates than full market cost. And the way historically we've done that is we've built social housing. We've provided housing to people that the state has some direct investment in, on the premise that not everybody can afford to rent at full market cost, or indeed afford to purchase their own home.
The current government has slashed investment in social housing so much that the housing crisis can only get worse. The only solution is to invest in social housing again, both through local authorities to build council homes and through housing associations to build social homes, in the way that the post-war government invested. And they need to be homes that people can afford, not homes that are called affordable, which are not.
If you build a council estate and people move in, those people pay rent to the local authority. After a few years, then the cost of building has paid for itself. Whereas if you have private rent, A, it's a lot more expensive, B, that money goes straight into landlords' pockets and doesn't get reinvested. It's a really good economic model, and it also points to the fact that housing should be a right for everybody.
In this documentary, we learn there's various misconceptions about social housing. Claudia, if I could ask you, why is there a need for social housing?
Well, social housing is really relevant in a local area where people, in a sense, can't afford to live in a home unless housing is provided that meets their ability to pay for that home. And in a sense, what we've got is a growing population and a basic need. And a basic need is a roof over your head. And if councils are deprived from building homes, then in a sense what you've got is demand outstripping supply. And really what the documentary highlighted by showing clips of Margaret Thatcher, it highlights Thatcherism and the policies of Thatcherism, which at the time...
Which was the right to buy scheme.
Which was, one, the issue about right to buy, but two, under Thatcherism, they stopped councils from building council homes. Councils used to be a machine for council homes. So within local authorities, you not only saw the production of homes, but you also saw the architects, the builders, the quantity surveyors, all of the professional skill sets located within a council. Those skill sets have long gone.
And thank you for that point and shedding light on the need for social housing. And Mike, if I can turn to you now, we learned from the film that there are various stigmatisms about social housing. What are they? What are some of these stigmatisms?
Well, one of the issues that the film addresses very well is the recent rise of TV shows like Benefit Street and things like that, where people who live on housing estates are, you know, it's these places are called sink estates, and you know there's a certain stigma that goes with that. But there's a portrayal of people who live on estates as feckless and, you know, alcoholic, and you know someone who's
scrounging.
Exactly, that's the kind of show. And these shows are very cheap to produce, like all reality TV, very cheap to produce, can get syndicated and make a TV channel or production company lots of money. What they actually give back to a society, a country, a community, it's very little. It's, you know, to stigmatize the people who appear on these shows and people who live on council estates in general. And I think part of that is that because these shows are made by people from outside those communities looking in. And it's often, as the film suggests, people who actually live on council estates, they have a community, they have a life there, they know where they're going, they know, you know, where their house relates to other people, the people who live next door to them. And it's not a sink estate. It's they're not circling the plug hole. You know, they're getting by. These places are functional, but they're being depicted in such a way as to suggest that they're not, and that they need knocking down.
We're going to continue this discussion in the next part.
I want there to be no hope areas in the new Britain that we want to create.
In his first public speech following Labour's landslide victory in 1997's general election, Tony Blair stood on the Aylesbury estate in south-east London and vowed there would be no forgotten people in the Britain his party wanted to build. 20 years later, residents of the Aylesbury might wonder what happened to New Labour's bold vision of the future. Since 2001, campaigners have fought against Southwark Council's plans to regenerate the estate. The council argued that the Aylesbury needs to be demolished due to the high cost of essential repairs. Campaigners claim that the council allowed the estate to deteriorate in order to facilitate its demise and justify a £1.5 billion redevelopment project.
So we saw Tony Blair there. And Claudia, I have to ask you, why didn't Blair fulfil his promises?
Well, I mean, I think the reality is that when, in 1997, Labour came into power in the aftermath of Thatcherism, in the aftermath of councils not being invested in to build council housing. And, you know, one could have wished and hoped that the new policy of Labour would have been to enable councils to build council homes again. A good council will build good quality homes, and with the resources and the investment, will invest in the stock that it has. But equally, if designs aren't right, and you know designs for their time aren't always fit for the future, and you then need to think about how do you make that housing stock work? How do you make it livable and continue to be enjoyable? But equally, what's important is, and what I fundamentally believe in, is if you are going to regenerate an estate, then what you need to bring back is council housing. You regenerate the estate to create continued council homes, and that we shouldn't need to, as councils, go into business with the private sector and sell off the land and sell off the homes for profit. And that's what councils need investment, so they don't have to do that. Maybe that they weren't presented with was the investment that was necessary to rebuild council homes rather than engage in a partnership with the private sector.
So you're saying that the Labour Party, the New Labour back then, effectively inherited this crisis. But Mike, from the documentary, I get the sense that the Conservative Party are much to blame, but do Labour share as much blame also?
Well, one of the strengths of the film is that it recognises that this is essentially a non-partisan issue. You know, everyone, whether you're of the right or of the left, needs a roof above your head. And I think it recognises, as much as, you know, Labour and the Conservatives like to play this fun game on Question Time of blaming one another for previous policies, there is a degree to which both parties are to blame, and this is why we're in the situation that we're in now. But yes, that right to buy scheme was, although a huge success at the time, has proven to have taken so many properties out of the public sphere and put them in private hands. But I think at the same time, the film says that, you know, when Tony Blair did come into power, not enough was done to counteract that policy. It was seen as such a sort of overwhelming success. What can you do? You know, well, you could build more houses, and I think that was one of the issues that leads to the situation that we're in right now, that we simply don't have enough houses for the people who need them.
And another, I want to talk about a different aspect of the documentary now. And one of the effects of the housing crisis seems to be the dismantling of the sense of community. I get this sense from the documentary that the film suggests that there were outside parties that were directly targeting and sort of dividing the community in order to conquer it. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is, in some ways, what the film is talking about is the direction of the entire nation over the past 50 years. I mean, we're told very early on that a lot of social housing was built close to factories, close to industries. And of course, once those industries closed down in the 60s, 70s, 80s, the last decade or so, where do the people who live on those estates go now? You know, how do they pay their rent? And if they can't pay their rents, does someone come in and take their property away from them? So that it's raising bigger questions than just questions around housing. It's about, you know, who, you know, how much responsibility do councils have for the people who live in within their remit.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll just have to pause there again just for now. I'll let you get back to that point, Claudia.
As the estate falls into decay, I believe it was a deliberate strategy of the local authority because they saw the Elephant Castle at the time as a prime market for real estate.
I haven't got all the details on the Haygate, but my understanding is that some of the social rented properties will be built in another part of the borough. But again, it's around the fact that if we are going to take down a certain number of social rented properties, it's about making sure we're re-providing that, actually re-providing more for the same level of rent.
For the demolition of 9,000 plus council homes and their replacement with luxury apartments costing £600,000 to £700,000 as an entry price, was their answer to the problem. That's no answer to the 9,000, 10,000 tenants that were living in secure accommodation at the time that are now dispersed across London and many dispersed outside of London.
People who benefit from the housing crisis are, of course, property developers. They want to have the densest housing possible. And the best way to make dense housing is to build luxury apartments and to make it look like, you know, you're building a tall tower block, not to house many families as they did in the 60s and 70s, but to give a really slick community lifestyle.
Now, before we went to that clip, we were just talking about the notion of dismantling of the community by the outside parties. Claudia, did you agree with what Mike said?
Well, I mean, I have a different take on it because obviously we're in, my context is London, and I can see that in areas like Newark, in Nuneaton, for example, which had a coal industry, that if you create homes around a particular industry and then that industry disappears in terms of the mining industry, then you are left with homes and people without access to meaningful work. That's not the case in London. What you've got in London is a total land grab. It's a disgrace, really, in terms of a total land grab by big developers who are basically capitalising on the opportunity that is presented by the lack of inability of councils to build and invest in homes. The policy of not allowing councils to build homes, that is what's been problematic because it's been over decades and not over a few years. What we have now in places like my own borough, where we have a good council that is building good quality homes, we bucked the trend and we sought to build council homes and we sought to find ways to do that and ensure that we do not sell off council land. But where we have planning, where we give planning permissions to the developers where they've got their own private land, what unfortunately has been created historically over time is the notion of poor doors. We have a policy of 50% of that must be affordable, meaning, you know, social rent properties. And what they do is they build that integral to the development, but they build it on the side or at the back, and that's where the creation of poor doors happens.
Of course,
it's
you're in Jeremy Corbyn's borough, and he's pledged to end the housing crisis. But I want to talk about this notion now in the film of social cleansing, which seems to be a contentious, controversial term, which means that low-income workers are being driven out of the capital, London, because of the soaring rents and the interests of corporations, of course, and real estate agents. What do we learn in the film about this?
The film's very good on gentrification and how neighbourhoods have changed rapidly over the last 10, 15, 20 years. So, you know, social housing is of less concern than attracting middle-class renters with lots of disposable income who can afford coffee and hummus and all the treats of living in the inner cities. But you know, there is a degree to which housing policy seems to have been skewed specifically, almost exclusively towards that particular demographic. And of course that, you know, drives out people who are originally living there. And you know, that's one of the many big issues that this film addressed.
Well, part of that was, you know, the whole huge banking crisis that happened. You know, what happened after the banking crisis was in London, then London's property market was then used as the place where people invest. And so what you've got is overseas investors purchasing land and property, never ever living in those properties and creating a this and them scenarios and situations. What is a disgrace is when it's set against that. So you've already got that as a problem going on. Set against that is when councils have got land and homes in council control. What is a disgrace is councils then selling that off in some kind of partnership with the private sector.
It is such a complex issue.
It is.
And unfortunately, we're running out of time in this programme. And just final 30 seconds to Mike. Would you recommend this documentary?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're now in a situation